thank you all for coming. I see a big row of family here, so I'm really pleased about that. Extra ones I didn't know were coming. I want to start by saying that in writing this collection of poems, what I wanted to do was to sort of set out to record and document often forgotten and buried histories, those histories that are both public and personal. And in that way, I think that these poems become a kind of pilgrimage to that lost past and an elegy for the people and places that make up what I call home. So I'm going to begin with reading some poems in an elegiac mood. And these are poems for my mother. Before I start there, though, I'd like to actually start with a poem that feels very strange to me now. It's the first poem in the collection, written a couple of years ago. What's strange about it now is that it's very much about a return to my hometown. And my hometown is Gulfport, Mississippi. And this was a poem that was very elegiac when I wrote it, but of course the place was still there when I wrote it. Theories of time and space. You can get there from here, though there's no going home. Everywhere you go will be somewhere you've never been. Try this. Head south on Mississippi 49, one by one, mile markers ticking off another minute of your life. Follow this to its natural conclusion. Dead end at the coast, the pier at Gulfport, where riggings of shrimp boats are loose stitches in a sky threatening rain. Cross over the man-made beach, 26 miles of sand dumped on the mangrove swamp, buried terrain of the past. Bring only what you must carry, tome of memory, its random blank pages. On the dock where you board the boat for Ship Island, someone will take your picture. The photograph, who you were, will be waiting when you return. Some of you might know that the Southern Crescent was the name of an old train. I think they kept the name of the train, even though Amtrak took over. But part of its route was between New Orleans and Atlanta. The Southern Crescent. One. In 1959, my mother is boarding a train. She is barely 16, her one large grip bulging with homemade dresses, whisper of crinoline and lace, her name stitched inside each one. She is leaving behind the dirt roads of Mississippi, the film of red dust around her ankles, the thin whistle of wind through the floorboards of the shotgun house, the very idea of home. Ahead of her, days of travel, one town after the next, and California, a word she can't stop repeating. Over and over, she will practice meeting her father, imagine how he must look, how different now from the one photo she has of him. She will look at it once more, pulling into the station at Los Angeles, and then again and again on the platform, no one like him in sight. Two. The year the old Crescent makes its last run, my mother insists we ride it together. We leave Gulfport late morning, heading east. Years before, we rode together to meet another man, my father, waiting for us as our train derailed. I don't recall how she must have held me, how her face sank as she realized again the uncertainty of it all. That trip, too, gone wrong. Today, she is sure we can leave home, bound only for whatever awaits us, the sun now setting behind us, the rails humming like anticipation, the train pulling us toward the end of another day. I watch each small town pass before my window until the light goes and the reflection of my mother's face appears, clearer now as evening comes on, dark and certain. This next poem has an epigraph from Robert Herrick. Fair daffodils, we weep to see you haste away so soon. Genus Narcissus. The road I walked home from school was dense with trees and shadow, creekside and lit by yellow daffodils, early blossoms bright against winter's last gray days. I must have known they grew wild, thought no harm in taking them, so I did, gathering up as many as I could hold, then presenting them in a jar to my mother. She put them on the sill, and I sat nearby, watching light bend through the glass, day easing into evening, proud of myself for giving my mother some small thing. Childish vanity. I must have seen in them some measure of myself, the slender stems, each blossom a head lifted up toward praise, or bowed to meet its reflection. Walking home those years ago, I knew nothing of Narcissus or the daffodil's short spring, how they dry like graveside flowers, rustling when the wind blew, a whisper treacherous from the sill. Be taken with yourself, they said to me. Die early to my mother. This next poem is a blues sonnet, Graveyard Blues. It rained the whole time we were laying her down. Rained from church to grave when we put her down. The suck of mud at our feet was a hollow sound. When the preacher called out, I held up my hand. When he called for a witness, I raised my hand. Death stops the body's work, the soul's a journeyman. The sun came out when I turned to walk away, glared down on me as I turned and walked away, my back to my mother, leaving her where she lay. The road going home was pocked with holes. That home-going road's always full of holes. Though we slow down, time's wheel still rolls. I wander now among names of the dead. My mother's name, stone pillow for my head. This next poem relies a bit on the myth of Orpheus and Eurydice. Myth. I was asleep while you were dying. It's as if you slipped through some rift, a hollow I make between my slumber and my waking, the Erebus I keep you in, still trying not to let go. You'll be dead again tomorrow, but in dreams you live. So I try taking you back into morning. Sleep heavy, turning, my eyes open, I find you do not follow. Again and again, this constant forsaking. Again and again, this constant forsaking. My eyes open, I find you do not follow. You back into morning, sleep heavy, turning. But in dreams you live, so I try taking, not to let go. You'll be dead again tomorrow. The Erebus I keep you in, still trying, I make between my slumber and my waking. It's as if you slipped through some rift, a hollow. I was asleep while you were dying. In making this pilgrimage and this elegy back to those places, to the place that my mother is buried, to the place of my early childhood, my own history, the place that I returned to, I actually did have to go there. And this next poem is called Pilgrimage, Vicksburg, Mississippi. Here, the Mississippi carved its mud-dark path, a graveyard for skeletons of sunken riverboats. Here, the river changed its course, turning away from the city as one turns, forgetting from the past. the abandoned bluffs, land sloping up above the river's bend, where now the Yazoo fills the Mississippi's empty bed. Here the dead stand up in stone, white marble on Confederate Avenue. I stand on ground once hollowed by a web of caves. They must have seemed like catacombs in 1863 to the woman sitting in her parlor, candlelit, underground. I can see her listening to shells explode, writing herself into history, asking what is to become of all the living things in this place. This whole city is a grave. Every spring, pilgrimage, the living come to mingle with the dead, brush against their cold shoulders in the long hallways, listen all night to their silence and indifference, relive their dying on the green battlefield. At the museum, we marvel at their clothes, preserved under glass, so much smaller than our own, as if those who wore them were only children. We sleep in their beds, the old mansions hunkered on the bluffs, draped in flowers, funereal, a blur of petals against the river's gray. The brochure in my room calls this living history. The brass plate on the door reads Prissy's room. A window frames the river's crawl toward the gulf. In my dream, the ghost of history lies down beside me, rolls over, pins me beneath a heavy arm. This next poem is a poem in four parts about four photographs. It's called Scenes from a Documentary History of Mississippi. 1. King Cotton, 1907. From every corner of the photograph, flags wave down the main street in Vicksburg. Stacked to form an arch, the great bales of cotton rise up from the ground like a giant swell, a wave of history flooding the town. When Roosevelt arrives, a parade, the band will march, and from every street corner, flags wave down. Words on a banner, Cotton, America's King, have the sound of progress. This is 2 years before the South's countermarch, those great bowls of cotton risen up from the ground, infested with boll weevils, a plague, biblical, all around. Now, Negro children ride the bales, clothes stiff with starch. From up high in the photograph, they wave flags down for the president who will walk through the arch, bound to for the future, his back to us. The children on their perch, those great bales of cotton rising up from the ground, stare out at us. Cotton surrounds them, a swell, a great mound, bearing them up, back toward us. From the arch, from every corner of the photograph, flags wave down and great bales of cotton rise up from the ground. 2. Glyph, Aberdeen, 1913. The child's head droops as if in sleep. Stripped to the waist in profile, he's balanced on the man's lap. The man, gaunt in his overalls, cradles the child's thin arm, the sharp elbow, white signature of skin and bone, pulls it forward to show the deformity, the humped back, curve of spine, punctuating the routine hardships of their lives, how the child must follow him into the fields, haunting the long hours, slumped beside a sack, his body asking how much cotton, or in the kitchen, leaning into the icebox, how much food, or kneeling beside him at the church house, why, Lord, why? They pose as if to say, look, this is the outline of suffering, the child shouldering it, a mound like dirt heaped on a grave. 3. Flood. They have arrived on the back of the swollen river, the barge dividing it, their few belongings clustered about their feet. Above them, the National Guard hunkers on the levee, rifles tight in their fists, they block the path to high ground. One group of black refugees, the caption tells us, was ordered to sing their passage onto land like a chorus of prayer, their tongues the tongues of dark bells. Here, the camera finds them still, posed as if for a school day portrait, children lace fingers in their laps. One boy gestures allegiance, right hand over the heart's charged beating. The great river all around, the barge invisible beneath their feet, they fix on what's before them, the opening in the sight of a rifle, the camera's lens, the muddy cleft between barge and dry land, all of it aperture, the captured moment's chasm in time. Here, in the angled light of 1927, they are refugees from history. The barge has brought them this far. They are waiting to disembark. 4. You are late. The sun is high and the child's shadow, almost fully beneath her, touches the sole of her bare foot on concrete. Even though it must be hot, she takes the step. Her goal to read is the subject of this shot, a book in her hand, the library closed, the door just out of reach. Stepping up, she must look at the two signs, read them slowly once more. The first one, in pale letters, barely shows against the white background. Though she will read Greenwood Public Library for Negroes, the other bold letters on slate will lead her away, out of the frame, a finger pointing left. I want to call her, say, wait, but this is history. She can't linger. She'll read the sign that I read. You are late. I can't read Flood now without thinking about some of those images from New Orleans, too. This next poem has a sort of a borrowed final line from Faulkner's Absalom. Pastoral. In the dream, I am with the fugitive poets. We're gathered for a photograph. Behind us, the skyline of Atlanta, hidden by the photographer's backdrop, a lush pasture, green, full of soft-eyed cows, lowing, a chant that sounds like no, no, yes, I say, to the glass of bourbon I'm offered. We're lining up now, Robert Penwarren, his voice just audible above the drone of bulldozers, telling us where to stand. Say, race. The photographer croons, I'm in blackface again when the flash freezes us. My father's white, I tell them, and rural. You don't hate the South, they ask. You don't hate it. My first job was at Auburn University, and I went there in 1997. But just a year before that, a year or two before that, the state had finally put to a vote whether or not to remove the anti-miscegenation laws from the books. And they voted, and they did vote to remove it, although 40-some percent of the population wanted to keep it, wanted to prevent parents like mine from getting married and people like me from being born legitimately, at least symbolically, in the state. This is a puzzle, and it's called Miscegenation. In 1965, my parents broke two laws of Mississippi. They went to Ohio to marry, returned to Mississippi. They crossed the river into Cincinnati, a city whose name begins with a sound like sin, the sound of wrong, miss in Mississippi. A year later, they moved to Canada, followed a route the same as slaves, the train slicing the white glaze of winter, leaving Mississippi. Faulkner's Joe Christmas was born in winter, like Jesus. given his name for the day he was left at the orphanage, his race unknown in Mississippi. My father was reading War and Peace when he gave me my name. I was born near Easter, 1966, in Mississippi. When I turned 33, my father said, "It's your Jesus year. You're the same age he was when he died." It was spring, the hills green in Mississippi. I know more than Joe Christmas did. Natasha is a Russian name, though I'm not. It means Christmas child, even in Mississippi. My mother dreams another country. Already the words are changing. She is changing from colored to Negro, black, still years ahead. This is 1966. She is married to a white man, and there are more names for what grows inside her. It is enough to worry about words like mongrel and the infertility of mules and mulattoes while flipping through a book of baby names. She has come home to wait out the long months, her room unchanged since she's been gone, dolls winking down from every shelf, all of them white. Every day she is flanked by the rituals of superstition, and there is a name she will learn for this too, maternal impression, the shape like an unknown country marking the back of the newborn's thigh. For now, women tell her to clear her head, to steady her hands, or she'll gray a lock of the child's hair wherever she worries her own, imprint somewhere the outline of a thing she craves too much. They tell her to stanch her cravings by eating dirt. All spring, she has sat on her hands, her fingers numb. For a while each day, she can't feel anything she touches. The arbor out back, the landscape's green tangle, the molehill of her own swelling. Here, outside the city limits, cars speed by, clouds of red dust in their wake. She breathes it in, Mississippi, then drifts towards sleep, thinking of some place she's never been. Late, Mississippi is a dark backdrop bearing down on the windows of her room. On the TV in the corner, the station signs off, broadcasting its nightly salutation, the waving stars and stripes, our national anthem. Southern Gothic. I have lain down into 1970, into the bed my parents will share for only a few more years. Early evening, they have not yet turned from each other in sleep, their bodies curved, parentheses framing the separate lives they'll wake to. Dreaming, I am again the child with too many questions, the endless why and why and why. My mother cannot answer, her mouth closed, a gesture toward her future, cold lips stitched shut. The lines in my young father's face deepen toward an expression of grief. I have come home from the schoolyard with the words that shadow us in this small southern town. Peckerwood and nigger lover, half-breed and zebra, words that take shape outside us. We're huddled on the tiny island of bed, quiet in the language of blood. The house unsteady on its cinder block haunches, sinking deeper into the muck of ancestry. Oil lamps flicker around us, our shadows, dark glyphs on the wall, bigger and stranger than we are. Incident. We tell the story every year, how we peered from the windows, shades drawn, though nothing really happened, the charred grass now green again. We peered from the windows, shades drawn, at the cross trussed like a Christmas tree, the charred grass still green. Then we darkened our rooms, lit the hurricane lamps. At the cross trust like a Christmas tree, a few men gathered, white as angels in their gowns. We darkened our rooms and lit hurricane lamps, the wicks trembling in their fonts of oil. It seemed the angels had gathered, white men in their gowns. When they were done, they left quietly. No one came. The wicks trembled all night in their fonts of oil. By morning, the flames had all dimmed. When they were done, the men left quietly. No one came. Nothing really happened. By morning, all the flames had dimmed. We tell the story every year. And a hurricane poem. This is Providence. What's left is footage. The hours before Camille, 1969, hurricane parties, palm trees leaning in the wind, fronds blown back, a woman's hair. Then after, the vacant lots, boats washed ashore, a swamp where graves had been. I recall how we huddled all night in our small house, moving between rooms, emptying pots filled with rain. The next day, our house on its cinder blocks seemed to float in the flooded yard, no foundation beneath us, nothing I could see tying us to the land. In the water, our reflections trembled, disappeared when I bent to touch it. I'm going to finish up with three poems. This next poem, I was telling my mother-in-law, Carmen, about this before coming here tonight. She asked a really good question, and that was, why is it that these elegies for your mother are in this book, which is also very much about Mississippi history, and there's a Civil War section in it. And I told her that I had been thinking about buried history, about what was lost or forgotten. And I thought I was writing things that were separate until I went to visit my mother's grave and came face to face with the fact that 20 years later, I had not yet put a monument there. And so she had become somehow part of this buried history that had been erased from the landscape. And I thought it was all about these black Union soldiers. This is Monument. Today, the ants are busy beside my front steps, weaving in and out of the hill they're building. I watch them emerge and, like everything I've forgotten, disappear into the subterranean, a world made by displacement. In the cemetery last June, I circled, lost, weeds and grass grown up all around, the landscape blurred and waving. At my mother's grave, ants streamed in and out like arteries, a tiny hill rising above her untended plot. Bit by bit, red dirt piled up, spread like a rash on the grass. I watched a long time the ants' determined work, how they brought up soil of which she will be part, and piled it before me. Believe me when I say I tried not to begrudge them their industry, this reminder of what I haven't done. Even now, the mound is a blister on my heart, a red and humming swarm. I mentioned those black soldiers, the black soldiers that give the title to this collection. The Louisiana Native Guards were the first officially sanctioned regiment of African American soldiers in the Civil War. They were stationed off the coast of my hometown on Ship Island at a fort called Fort Massachusetts. Their primary duty once they got out there was to guard Confederate prisoners of war. The island is still intact, though it has lost some mass. During Hurricane Camille, the center of the island washed out, which is where all the graves had been. And so even Mother Nature is complicit in sort of washing away and erasing certain parts of history. I went out there this past April on the anniversary of Appomattox, to shoot a little documentary, and the black reenactors were actually there. And even though they were about 20 yards away, I watched several of the park rangers. The park is run by the National Park Service. give tours, and throughout the tour, they never mentioned anything about the black population on the island. They were just 20 feet away. This poem has an epigraph from Alan Tate's Ode to the Confederate Dead that reads, "Now that the salt of their blood stiffens the saltier oblivion of the sea." Elegy for the Native Guards. We leave Gulfport at noon, gulls overhead trailing the boat, streamers, noisy fanfare, all the way to Ship Island. What we see first is the fort, its roof of grass, a lee, half reminder of the men who served there, a weathered monument to some of the dead. Inside, we follow the ranger, hurried though we are to get to the beach. He tells of graves lost in the Gulf, the island split in half when Hurricane Camille hit, shows us casemates, cannons, the store that sells souvenirs, tokens of history long buried. The Daughters of the Confederacy has placed a plaque here at the fort's entrance, each Confederate soldier's name raised hard in bronze, no names carved for the Native Guards, 2nd Regiment, Union men, black phalanx. What is monument to their legacy? All the grave markers, all the crude headstones, water lost. Now fish dart among their bones, and we listen for what the waves intone. Only the fort remains, near 40 feet high, round, unfinished, half open to the sky, the elements, wind, rain, God's deliberate eye. This last poem has an epigraph from E.O. Wilson that reads, "Homo sapiens is the only species to suffer psychological exile." South. I returned to a stand of pines, bone-thin phalanx flanking the roadside, tangle of understory, a dialectic of dark and light, and magnolias blossoming like afterthought, each flower a surrender, white flags draped among the branches. I returned to Land's End, the swath of coast clear-cut and buried in sand, mangrove, live oak, gulf weed raised and replaced by thin palms, palmettos, symbols of victory or defiance, over and over, marking this vanquished land. I returned to a field of cotton, hallowed ground as slave legend goes, each bowl holding the ghosts of generations, those who measured their days by the heft of sacks and lengths of rows, whose sweat flecked the cotton plants still sown into our clothes. I returned to a country battlefield where colored troops fought and died, Port Hudson where their bodies swelled and blackened beneath the sun, unburied until Earth's green sheet pulled over them, unmarked by any headstones. Where the roads, buildings, and monuments are named to honor the Confederacy, where that old flag still hangs, I return to Mississippi, state that made a crime of me, mulatto, half-breed, native, in my native land, this place, they'll bury me.